Hey everybody, it's Mike Johnson back in the audio section of PWInsiderElite.com, and we are on the line with someone who's held a number of different personalities in professional wrestling. And when they said wrestling went to the circus, he really topped that phrase because he portrayed the original, and some say the best version of Doink the Clown. Before that, he was Maniac Matt Bourne, the son of Tough Tony Bourne, and has been around the business for many, many years, and on March 27th in Garfield, New Jersey, will be part of ISPW Mania, where he'll be debuting his newest persona, Reborn Again. So, Matt Bourne, thank you for joining us, and how are you doing today, sir?
Good, good. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Now, the Reborn Again persona is a throwback to your short run in the original ECW, where you came in as Doink. You were defeated by 9-1-1, and then that's the night Shane Douglas won the NWA tournament, threw the belt down, became the ECW World Champion, and then you were going to be his second under the name Bourne Again, where you kind of had half your face was painted as Doink, and then the character promptly disappeared. You left ECW short thereafter. Why did you leave ECW to begin with at that point, and then what led to the idea of doing the Reborn Again character here in ISPW, and I'm assuming elsewhere?
Oh, okay. Well, actually, my ECW run was actually meant to be a little longer. I had got an offer to go over to overseas to Germany, and it was an offer I couldn't refuse, and so I talked to Paulie, who was the boss there, and I told him what the situation was, and he said, "Oh man, you can't turn that down." So he said, "That's cool. Just give me a call when you get back." And I was over there for a month, and when I came back, I gave him a call, but then he never returned it. So he obviously had a change of plans. But yeah, that's the reason why I had all intentions of coming back and working with the ECW, but I guess they didn't want me.
Guess not. Yeah. So the Reborn Again character, where did that come from?
Well, it's kind of like a cross between the character I was doing as Doink in the WWF and the Reborn Again and the Born Again. Just getting back in, and I'd given him a lot of thought, and I want to give back to the industry that has given me so much and been such a huge part of my life, and want to just push the envelope a little bit more. You know, I pushed the envelope quite a bit with Doink, with the WWF, and it was very successful, and you know, I think I can have success with this too, and you know, giving it a shot and running with it, and we'll kind of write it as it goes, as we go, and I'm just looking really forward to it, man. I think it's a great character. I think I can play it to the T, and we'll just see.
Right. Now, I want to make a quick correction. At the beginning of the audio, I said Garfield, New Jersey. It's actually in Freehold, so before Tommy Fierro calls me and yells at me, it's in Freehold.
Right, right.
Now, the Doink the Clown character, I guess, is what most fans today would know you for. You had a long career before that, and I'd like to get into that in a bit. But when you first heard the concept for Doink the Evil Clown, what were your thoughts on it?
Well, actually, it was like I didn't have a response. I was at a loss for words. I think my jaw dropped, you know. Like, you know, for all my career, I tried to portray myself as a strong competitor, kind of old school type wrestling, balls to a wall, so to speak, you know, and being a tough guy. And then when this idea came from Vince McMahon, it just caught me totally off guard, you know. I didn't know what to say, and he actually, when he first presented it to me, there was probably a moment of it seemed like an eternity, but there was the silence there because I think he was trying to get a response from me and my feelings, but I didn't know what to say. I mean, that was the last thing that I would ever imagine you know, being thrown at me like that. And then after that long period of silence, it was only probably only a few seconds, but it seemed like an eternity. It was thrown at me that, you know, I didn't have to do it. Because they had just given me a contract and without any kind of a character, and it was, you know, it was offered to me to, you know, if I had another idea, you know, that I could throw something else on the table and discuss that. But actually, Vince, I've always admired him for, you know, he is a creative genius and, you know, head and shoulders above anybody else in the industry. And he's got a way of bringing out a certain quality in guys' personalities that can come out in their professional in their professional abilities too. And so, just given that, I went home and, you know, I was living in Atlanta at the time, and I just I slept on it. You know, I pondered it, and I even had dreams. You know, I went, you know, it was just totally consumed my brain, and I discussed it with my wife at the time, and she really didn't have much say about it. She just more or less left the ball in my court. But I thought about it for like 3 or 4 days, and I got back with them, back with the WWF, and so let's roll with it. You know, I knew that. Given the power of Vince McMahon, that if I could pull it off, and I knew, you know, he even explained to me there was a fine line there, you know. I mean, either it was going to work or it wasn't. And but he believed in me. He expressed that to me, that he believed that I could do it. But I had to believe it too. You know, if I'm going to do something, I've got to believe in myself. So I came to the point where, you know, if I do this and pull this off, Vince is going to see it, and, you know, it's going to roll. You know, it's going to fly. So so that's exactly what I did. And then I called him, and I said, yeah, I'm good with it. So we went from there and, you know, got the look down and got the, you know, started doing it, you know. And there was no set format for it. It was totally new. It was... nothing like that had ever been done in the industry before, and it was really pushing the envelope. So we just kind of wrote it as we went. You know, I just followed Vince's lead.
Now, the Doink character itself, the name of the character, do you have any idea where the origin of that came from? Because no one seems to know. It's like this weird urban legend just popped up one day. Do you have any idea who came up with it?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I was in Atlanta, and I was getting all this feedback with the character and different looks for the costume. And I had input on what kind of a costume I wanted, you know, whether I wanted something baggier or something somewhat tight on me. And so, but this, as far as the design goes, they have departments there that design all that stuff. But as far as the name goes, I had received a list from WWF of, oh man, I bet you there was 25, 30 names on there. And I was asked to pull some out, you know, circle some that I liked. And I think I circled five names, and Doink was one of them. And whoever decided Doink was it, you know, I have no idea, but it was definitely one of the names that I circled on that sheet.
Right. Now, I have to ask you, we mentioned at the beginning of this, you're a second-generation guy. Your dad, Tony Bourne, worked Pacific Northwest and Texas in a million and one different territories.
Right.
What do you think his reaction to you portraying that character would have been, given that he was an old-school guy who came up in that era?
You know what, when I told him about it, in fact, he had come down to Atlanta and visited me, and I showed him everything that I had up to that point. And my dad is like classic old school, and as far as him talking to me about it, he really didn't have too many words to say. he just looked, and, you know, what he was thinking, he might have been thinking, you know, both positive and negative, you know, but I expressed how I felt about it, you know, given my relationship with Vince at the time, and just the fact that, hey, I think I showed him that I thought I could do it, and I talked about some different old-timers that had an influence on my life, like Moondog Maine was a huge one, a bunch of guys, John Tolis, some old-timers that I knew when I was a youngster, and so he just listened to me, and he saw that, and he saw where I was coming from, and yeah, I think his words were, well, do it then, son, you know? And that was pretty much it. My dad, the main thing my dad told me about the business is, you know, I never even trained with my dad, but my dad was a phenomenal performer, and he made people believe. And the main thing he told me years and years ago was you sell to the nosebleed section, you know, and it's all in the face. It's not what you do, it's how you do it. And those words always embedded in me and in my work. You know, I tried to make people believe what I'm doing when I'm doing it. You know, it's the face is so much, you know, so much, your facial expressions and what you're doing. And it, as far as doing it goes, it's all. I mean, it's even more so in the face for me, you know. I mean, it was, Doink was, you had to see my face to know where I was or to where I wanted you to think my head was. You know, it was all in the face for me.
Right. Now, the Doink character had several major high points. To me, the best actual match he had was in SummerSlam 1993 in Chicago. Bret Hart was to wrestle Jerry Lawler.
That was in Saginaw.
Was it Saginaw, Michigan? I apologize. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're right, it was Michigan. I apologize. Jerry Lawler was supposed to wrestle Bret Hart, feigned an injury, and he sent you out as the replacement. And then, of course, after your match, they did a big angle with Lawler and Bret. But the actual match between yourself and Bret was probably the best quote-unquote doink match inside the ring. Any memories of that match that stand out? Like, that's like one of those overlooked really good classic wrestling matches, especially considering the character was more someone who played mind games as opposed to as like an in-ring performer.
Yeah, I agree with you. I used to love to work with Bret. We just clicked, you know. We in that match, I'll bet you we didn't say more than 10 words that whole match to each other. We understood how we were starting it. We understood how we were finishing it. And in between, it was all improvisation, and it was always a pleasure to be in there with Bret. One thing I do remember about the match is when we started it, I think the Hart family was sitting ringside, and Bruce Hart was, and I had never met Bruce Hart at that point in time, and later we became really good friends. In fact, I was over in Germany with him for a month, and anyway, Bruce was sitting there in his suit and ringside, and Pat Patterson, I remember he came up to me, he was laughing his butt off, and he pulled me aside, and he says, Bruce Hart, and he showed me who he was and where he was sitting at, and he wanted me to go out there with, you know, I would take confetti out there sometimes and water out there, or pies or whatever, and he wanted me to douche Bruce Hart with a bucket of water, and that Bruce had no idea it was coming, you know. And you know, I was down with that, you know. That's just cool. So Bret was what he knew what was up, but nobody else did, you know. So, you know, I went through there and did my little thing, and then douched Bruce with the water, and I have to say it was kind of chilly water too. It was summertime, though, so it was all good. But, yeah, it was like just to see the reaction from him when I did that and the way he came over that railing, it was something else, you know. It took everything in me to keep from laughing so hard I couldn't move. And then we busted into the match, busted into it with Bret, and we just rolled from there. We just fed off each other. We sold each other, and you know, and that was, it was just like a night off.
The other moment that was kind of like the quintessential Doink moment was WrestleMania 9 in Vegas. You wrestling the late Bryan Adams, who was crushed at the time, and Steve Kern came under the ring as the second Doink. You guys kind of did the Harpo Marx mirror image deal. Where did that come from, and what was your reaction to the idea of having the multiple Doinks, especially when, based on the character, they could always recast you, and eventually they did?
Yeah, yeah. Never saw that coming, though. Steve Kern and I looked somewhat similar, you know, when we were younger. Anyway, I saw a little bit of similarity. When I was young in the business, before I had even met Steve Kern, I was in Carolinas, and I think Steve Kern was in Florida. And I had a lot of the guys and some fans even said, hey, you look like Steve Kern. And I had never even met the guy. I had never even seen him before. And so I had a lot of people tell me that. And then he was Skinner up there when I was started doing Doink. And geez, you really want to know where I think the thing came from is, wow, okay, you might want to bleep this, but I'm going to tell you. Because you asked me, and I'm going to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
There was one night, I don't even know where it was, Steve Kern must have been bored, and he grabbed my paint and took a little pinch of the green hair off my wig and painted his penis as Doink, and then walked around. The guy said, look, there's Dink. You know?
So that's probably where the other name came from.
I mean, you know, and that is the God's honest truth. And you know what? It was like people roared. The guys roared. And actually, I just shook my head, you know. But later on, there's a freaking midget. Midget was a little bit bigger than Steve Kern's penis, but they still called him Dink. And but you asked, but as far as Steve Kern doing the Doink thing, it was Steve Kern's idea, and he kind of wanted to push himself into the gimmick. You know, the character was getting a push. And it was getting over. And the finish that we were going to do in WrestleMania 9 originally got bumped because the finish got leaked out. So they bumped it, and they decided to do the thing with the double Doink thing. And Steve Kern, you know, they painted him up, and he went and sat under the ring for 5-6 hours before, you know, before he had the thing to do. And and then he wanted to roll with it, but you know, we used him as a distraction in some house shows where he would just come out as Doink and distract, and then, you know, go into a finish from there. But I was okay with it, you know, the distraction part, but I didn't want to do the tag team thing, you know, with Steve as Doink. You know, for a couple of different reasons, I just didn't want to do it. I, you know, it was actually my thing, you know, and it was, you know, nothing selfish about it. I just didn't want to do it. And, but as far as just doing it as a passing thing, and I expressed that to Vince, and Vince told me, don't worry about it, you know, but Steve was trying to push it, you know. He wanted to do it, and I was a little taken back about that because, you know, he never really approached me about it, and, you know, to, you know, get me on the same page as him. He just tried to, you know, go around me, and Steve and I, you know, I mean, we're friends. I mean, we've always been friends, but I just didn't like the, you know, the way that was done by him. But, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, that's how it started. And then I was running into problems, personal problems, and I was supposed to be going overseas, and I got scratched from the tour overseas because of problems I was having, personal problems that were rolling over into business, and so I stayed home, and Lombardi went over there as Doink in my place, and yeah.
Now, I guess it was the end of 93, Survivor Series of that year. They were supposed to do the thing with the four Doinks, and you were beginning the face turn and feuding with Bigelow. But by the time that pay-per-view came around, when the quote-unquote real Doink revealed himself on the video screen, it was Rey Apollo in the role, and he took it over. So what happened that led to your departure at the time, and how did you feel about them recasting the character? Like, did you take that as a personal, were you personally offended, or was it just, you know, business as usual to you? Like, how did you feel about that?
Well, I mentioned my problems, so, you know, my problems just kind of like dominoed, and, you know, I was released, because I had, you know, I had numerous chances, you know, but I kept screwing up my own thing, and, so when I was released and Rey was cast at it, actually I didn't have any sour or bitter emotions about it at all, because I had met Rey one time, is the only time I've ever even met Rey, and he was down at Offa's gym, and Offa was telling me, oh, there's this guy, he can do your laugh, he loves you, Matt, you gotta come down and meet this guy, he was a student of Offa's, I believe, and so we were in the area, and I said, okay, you know, one day I went down there to his gym, and I met him, and, oh, you gotta do him, so he got in the ring and freaking tried to do me, you know, and I smiled and laughed, and I, you know, shook his hand, I said, oh, that's great, man, you know, da-da-da-da, and so, so Bam Bam, he was a friend of Bam Bam's too, I guess, when I was released, I don't know if, you know, they were thinking about just having Lombardi do it or bringing back Steve Kern, because Steve had quit at the time for a bit, and I think, you know, that probably Bam Bam and Offa maybe had a hand in, you know, maybe getting Rey his break with him. And when Rey got that break, you know, I mean, getting a break in the business with the WWF, you know, is a huge break for any young guy coming up. And so, you know, I mean, you got to take your breaks when you get them. And so, no, I have no ill feelings about it at all. You know, I mean, I feel bad for Rey because, you know, Rey had to come in and jump into another personality that wasn't his. Like I had said before, that you know, if Rey could have come in and been a different character, you know, to where he could have been himself, and he didn't have to concentrate on talking and acting and doing things like somebody else, you know, and he could have been more innovative and been himself. It would have been probably better, but for him. But it's a tough thing to do, to, you know, try and clone somebody. But no, you know, I don't know Rey, and, you know, I'm sure he's a great guy, and but as far as him, you know, being cast as that character, it would have been a tough pill for me to swallow. But I don't know, you know, how he felt about it. I mean, it was a huge break for him, and, you know, I mean, he got to run with it. But the character, you know, kind of faded, you know, when he, you know, WWF wrote it, you know, pushed it for a while, and then, you know, it kind of went down. You know, it wasn't on the upswing still. It was kind of plateaued off and then kind of faded. But, you know, he got to start in the business with it, you know, so God bless them, you know.
Great. The Doink the Clown character is unique because it seems like every independent company at one point had their own Doink or Funny Clown or whatever running around.
Yeah.
When you were trying to do indies and get bookings as Doink, after or some sort of replica of Doink, because you couldn't use the name, was it frustrating to you to see like just some average guy was getting booked as the character and working the character for $50? It seemed like, especially up here in the Northeast, there were like 7 or 8 Doinks on a night.
Well, you know what? At first, when I was first released, I was getting all kinds of calls from the indie circuit to work, but I didn't want to have anything to do with it. You know, for, geez, I think it was like 5 months, I just said, no, don't want to, you know, and I was kind of like, I kind of went, like, withdrew and isolated myself and was in my own little depressive world for a while, and but then there came a time, I'll tell you, when I started doing the indies, is I got a phone call from a guy in Youngstown, Ohio, and I was living in Columbus at the time, and Kamala was supposed to be on the headlining the card for him, and the day of the show, I get this phone call from this guy, and he asked me if I could come up to Youngstown from Columbus, because Kamala wasn't going to be able to make it. And so, you know, we talked about it and worked out a thing on the phone with it, and I said, okay, so it's a 2.5-hour ride for me. So I jumped in my car, and I went up there, and had a heck of a crowd, you know, for an indie show, and, you know, did well, and, you know, and from then on, it was like my phone rang off the wall, and I said, you know what, I can do this, I'll do this. So I, almost immediately, you know, my calendar filled up, you know, for the weekends, which most of the indie shows are run on the weekends. So, yeah, from, I think that was like March 1st, 2nd is when I did that indie show up in Youngstown, and it was like no time at all. My every weekend was pretty much booked, and it was like that for, oh, man, it was almost about 9 months. There was no any, there wasn't any other promoters that had the outfit at that time. It was just me, and you know, I had to turn down guys because I was booked. I mean, there wasn't enough weekends in the week, you know. And when I had went to Germany, that's when I came back from Germany, that's when the WWF had sent out cease and desist orders to all the indie promoters, especially in the Northeast, to cease and desist using the Doink character, using, you know, the Doink character, period. So when I came back from Germany, I just, you know, I had a few bookings, but, you know, they all got these letters, so they just weren't doing it. And then, I don't know, it just kind of like happened, you know. One guy got, you know what, had somebody make him a Doink outfit, and they would slide it in on the card and put it on some jabroni, and you know, and then word got out, and then pretty soon everybody, all these guys got an outfit, and you know, then they rolled with it, you know, and I think it just really cheapened it. It wasn't a it wasn't box office anymore. It wasn't drawing anything, especially when you know, they would have the show and they would have this guy in this Doink outfit that, you know, couldn't portray the character, or let alone work, you know. And then it was just like, you know, what is it anymore? It's nothing, you know.
Before Doink, you worked a million and one different territories. You worked world class and actually held tag titles with Buzz Sawyer, who, one of the more infamous tough guys and some would say a bully in the business. Obviously, he's been gone for a number of years. What are your memories of working with Buzz?
Buzz was a phenomenal worker. He was, the guy was such a pleasure to watch. He just was a phenomenal athlete, unbelievable athlete. He was very physically tough, you know. But he had his demons, and he was off the hook, you know. He would get in a lot of trouble, and you know, have to leave territories and for legal reasons, and you know, his demons got him in the end. But Buzz and I, we butt heads a lot. You know, people thought that we were brothers, we were related somehow, but we weren't. But we worked together in the ring well as a tag team. But Buzz was just, we would always be butting heads. We were always fighting. But, you know, the memories I have of Buzz, I try to remember him for the good qualities he had, because the guy, I can remember one time we were coming back from Richmond, Virginia, and we were almost into Charlotte, and it was late at night, and there was a tractor trailer that had gone. The guy had fallen asleep and gone off the road, and the top of the trailer was still on the overpass, and the cab was wedged down on the street below, and there was a fire. It had just happened, and Buzz was driving, and he pulled over, and he jumped out, and I jumped out, and he ran right down there and watched this guy burn up in his cab. Buzz tore his shirt off and tried to open the door, because it was so hot from the fire, and you know, risked his own life to try to save a stranger. So that right there, you know, told me, you know, what the guy was made of, you know. But on the other hand, you know, he had an angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other. But I try and remember him for his good qualities. You know, a lot of guys will you know, say bad things about him and stuff, but, you know, I'm not going to ever do that. I could, you know, I could dwell on those things, but, you know, there's good and bad in everybody, and the good that Buzz had in him was huge.
We mentioned your match with Bret Hart at SummerSlam. Another highlight of the Doink run was actually you did a series of matches with Curt Hennig, building up the King of the Ring tournament, I believe in 93, the first tournament. What were your memories of that series, and then how do you compare Hennig, who sadly is no longer with us, to Bret as a worker in the ring?
You know what? It was very similar. Very similar. Kurt was another one that was a total pleasure to work with. Very, very similar. Kurt was another one that I never had to speak to. You know, we could convey our thoughts. We never choreographed a match. You know, I've never choreographed matches with any. When I would work with younger guys, I would have to go through some spots, and they would want to, you know, start choreographing. I'd say, hey, you know, whoa, you know, I mean, you know, I can't work like that, you know, because I've always believed that you got to keep an ear open to the crowd and to your audience, and know what they want. And, you know, experience will teach you that, you know, you have to, the same match won't work in Des Moines, Iowa, that, you know, it won't work in L.A. that worked in Des Moines, Iowa, you know, because you got, the crowds are different. So we would just wing it. We would just have an ear, and, you know, we wouldn't be afraid to settle down a little bit and be in a hold, and, you know, work the people a little bit, you know. We're not working each other. We're working the crowd, you know. And that's I don't know if it's a lost art, you know, or what, or, you know, things change. I realize that. But, you know, I think that old school and new school can mesh. And still, you know, there's so many qualities about old school that are imperative for guys to be great workers. And, you know, I think things change, and there's qualities about new school that you've got to have, you know. So times change, but I think if you lose the art of old school, then you've lost a huge part of it. You know, you got to remember where you come from, you know.
Look, as a veteran looking at the business today, and as someone who's starting to start to do indies again and get involved again, what are some of the changes that of the current regime that you see that really bother you as a worker, and then things that you feel are just completely forgotten or overlooked now that you'd like to see come back?
Well, you know what, I don't want to be too much of a critic, because what I personally like and don't like, or don't like about the current way the business is, you know, my thoughts about it aren't necessarily facts, and it's just my opinions. But, you know, I think there is a bit too much soap opera drama, just a hair, you know, maybe just a hair. You know, but maybe that's what the audience wants now. You know, so I'm not going to pass judgment. It's just my personal opinion, you know. Too much, you know, they can lose me out there sometimes when they're talking back and forth and they're feeding their egos, and, you know, that's it. And that's not a knock or anything, but, you know, they're trying to build this thing, and when it's all said and done, I can say, now, all that time, this is what I say to myself, all that time that they did this back and forth, standing there, and the end result, I said, was that worth it? You know, I mean, what? And I sometimes don't get it.
Like, there's too much character development being focused on the talking as opposed to what they could try and develop in the ring.
Yeah, you know, and you know what? I believe that the characters have to, you know, it's huge that they have to be developed. But you know what? I would really like to see. I would like to see characters developed out in the world, you know, like, take the cameras out. I mean, everything's reality shows now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So take the cameras out and get into these characters' lives outside of the arena. And then when the shit comes down in the arena, hey, let's get the business, you know? This is, you know, I don't know. That's just my own personal opinion. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, kind of mesh the room.
Too much time standing in the middle of the ring face to face with microphones in your mouth talking back and forth. You know, I think it could be that time in the ring could be done a little bit more action, a little bit more back to some the old school a little bit.
Right. You mentioned, I know you did an interview with Fiero on his podcast, and one of the things you talked about was you had just finished going through a WWE-sponsored rehabilitation program. It came out earlier this week that Eki Fatu, who portrayed Umaga, passed away due to a number of mixing of different drugs, acute intoxication due to mixing different pills. He had been let go by WWE because he refused to go to rehab. And WWE as a company really gets dragged through the mud, so, for some reasons fairly, for some reasons unfairly. We had a discussion earlier this week that WWE at this point in time is pretty much doing everything they can do. And think, you know, there's always going to be improvements in a program like their wellness policy. As someone who hasn't worked for them for a number of years other than that one appearance on Raw, the 15th anniversary show. Yep. What's your take on the wellness policy, given that you utilize their services to get help for yourself?
Well, I think they're doing a phenomenal job. I think the people that they have in charge of it give their heart and soul to it, and they're sincerely doing it not just as a job, as their job with the WWE, but they're doing it from their heart. I believe that if I would have been given the opportunity for being put through what I went through 15 years ago, I don't think I would have got out of it what I got out of it, because of the fact that I hadn't come to the point in my own life to where I really sincerely wanted something better for myself, wanting something better from the inside. And I just didn't know how. I didn't know how to live with drugs anymore. I mean, drugs used to be fun. It wasn't fun anymore, and it was like killing me, and I knew it. And I didn't know how to live without them, because I, for so long, I mean, the industry, years ago, in the industry, if you didn't party, you more than likely weren't really going to make it in the business. It was just the way it was. The guys that were box office, the guys that got pushes, the guys that were really creative, there's something about a personality in people, I think, that either they've got it or they don't. And the guys that have it have a certain type of personality that maybe it's a bit of an addictive personality. But things have changed now, you know. I mean, I look at, like, John Cena. I look at Chris Jericho. I look at a lot of guys that are phenomenal guys and workers and talents. And, you know, I don't see those problems. Even though I don't know them, I think they're class acts, and I think it's great for the business that they have these class people that they're pushing and they can believe in and they can trust with the company. Because when, you know, I never really understood that, you know, you've got to carry yourself outside of the ring just as well as you carry yourself inside of the ring in different aspects. You have to be a class citizen. You have to be a class person. And if you're not going to do that, you know, you're not doing the company any well. You're going to hurt yourself. You're going to hurt the company. But as far as what they're doing, I think it's phenomenal. I think they do a good job. But if anybody's going to get anything out of it, if they don't want sincerely inside themselves something better for themselves, if they still want to be able to run out and live the way they're living and do drugs and party and escape for whatever reason, then they're not going to get anything out of it. I don't care what you do. You know, you can lock them up. You can force them into freaking group meetings and put a psychiatrist in front of them. You can do whatever you want to do. But if they don't want to change, ain't nobody going to change them.
For yourself personally, do you feel like the wellness policy and going through that situation might help open up the door for you to get back in WWE in some sort of position, maybe as a producer, or to go back and do cameos at some point? Or are you just happy just to start doing indies again and moving on to whatever the next phase of your life is? Like, would you want to work for a national company again?
Oh, you know what? The wrestling business is what I know. It's been my life, and sure, I always want to be a part of the business, and I can't say that I wouldn't want to be involved on that level. But you know, I mean, time will tell. You know, I can't force the hand. You know, if they ever see something in me that they see could be an asset to their company, you know, I'm sure I'll hear about it. And if not, and then it's not my destiny. I've heard a lot of rumors that I was going back and working with them in different capacities, but that's not true. I don't know where those rumors started from. But sure, you know, I love this business. You know, I was born into this business. And you know, I've caused a lot of destruction in my path, you know, in this business. And you know, I'm a different person now, and you know, if I can make the right decisions, which I believe I am, and continue to make the right decisions and continue living the way I'm living, then my life is going to get better. And whether it's involved in the business, wrestling business, or whether it's not, my life is going to continue to get better. And, you know, that's all. I mean, I got to live and make the right decisions in my life and not just based on my desire to be a part of the wrestling industry. But yes, yes, I love this industry, and I want to give back. I want to do whatever I can to leave a positive mark and to help anybody that needs help in learning the business and dealing with problems. Anything I can do to be positive is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to make decisions based on that.
One of the things that everyone says is lacking in the business today is that there aren't enough veterans to kind of give their advice and give guys insight. Are you hoping that working the ISPW show and some of the other independents that you're going to work in the upcoming days, maybe you'll get a chance to kind of help the younger guys and pick their brains and influence them in terms of an older school way of looking at things and maybe helping out the business that way by, like, kind of getting the next generation ready? Like, is that something you're interested in doing?
Oh, absolutely. I'm looking so forward because most of them around here, the younger talent in the business, I don't know any of them. You know, I've had an opportunity to be around a few of them, and you know, as I see them, you know, I can tell they're great athletes, and I've been told these guys are a heck of a worker, and this guy was in the WWE developmental program a while back, and you know, so you know, I kind of know just by word of mouth, you know, who's where, but I am looking so forward to actually seeing these guys and watching them and talking with them and picking their brains. And you know, I'm not going to force myself on anybody, but if somebody, you know, wants to pick my brain, you know, I mean, I'm just like, yeah, yeah, please pick away. You know, I just, like I said, Mike, I just want to, I want to give back. And I know when I was breaking the business, how I wanted to learn, and I was just wanting to be a sponge. And so when guys are like that, I'm real perceptive, and I'm able to pick that up, and heck yeah, you know, I've been through a lot, and, you know, I was a king of mistakes, so, you know, I can be an asset, there's no doubt about that, but yeah, I'm looking as forward to that as I am, any aspect of, you know, working or whatever in the business. But doing these indies now, it's like so cool to me, you know. I mean, it's like I see it differently, you know, as years ago when I was doing indies before I even went to the WWF, you know, when I was like moving from territory to territory, and it's so much so different now, and there's so much more talent out there, and I mean, you got to be lucky in the business to get breaks. But I think we can form our own luck, too. Guys can form their own luck, and getting breaks and being in the right place at the right time means a lot, but you have to, there's certain steps, and there's certain mannerisms, there's certain ways that you got to carry yourself, and certain things you got to do to create those breaks.
Prior to Doink, you had that short run in WCW, I guess it was about a year, 18 months, where you came out of the crowd as Big Josh, the rugged outdoorsman fan who became a pro wrestler. Where did the mindset for that character come from in debuting you as a brand new character as opposed to, you know, Matt Bourne, the journeyman wrestler? And then you were there during an interesting time period. In 91, the company was not doing well. Flair had just left. The crowd kind of revolted against that. Dusty was booking. And then Bill Watts, who you knew obviously from Mid-South, came in and completely changed the landscape of the company, but after he was there a couple of months, you were gone. So take us through that time period and that journey.
Yeah, yeah. When Dusty got the job as the booker for WCW, I was, Jerry Jarrett would come in and bought World Class out, and I'd been working for him. And then I had went to North Carolina. They were trying to revive the NWA, George Scott, and so I had been talking to Dusty, and I had been working with Dustin in Texas with Jarrett's, and Dustin was kind of just breaking into the business. So Dusty told me when he got the book, you know, come down and meet me in the office. I think it was his first day down there, you know, in the office, and he hired me right away. You know, I think I was the first guy that Dusty hired when he got the book, and he asked me if I would be willing to change my character, and I said sure. You know, whatever you want. You know, he said okay. Well, let me kick it around and da 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 da, and I'll get back to you in a couple of days. It wasn't a couple of days. It was like 4 or 5 hours later. He called me and threw the big Josh thing at me, a lumberjack from the Northwest, and you know, I was from the Northwest, and you know, okay, and he told me the kind of look, and he wanted me to come in and sit down with him a little bit, and I said, yeah, sure, you know, everything was yes, so it was very simple, you know, look, I think I had the outfit and everything, and one afternoon, and then we rolled with it, you know, I was in the crowd, I was Tommy Rich's cousin or something from the North Woods or, you know, wherever they came off with it. But that was all new to me, and it wasn't like it was actually probably kind of good for me to do that before I, you know, jumped that line and did Doink later, because, you know, it just gave me a little taste of getting out of outside of myself. I don't think I felt real comfortable with it. But I did it, and, you know, it was good for me. You know, I got a contract out of it. And, but when Bill Watts came in and, took over the book, I was one of the first guys to go. He came to the dressing room one night and said, "We're going to get back to wrestling here. And da da da. If you don't wear wrestling boots, you might as well freaking pack your bags," you know. And I didn't wear wrestling boots out there. I remember JYD was sitting there right next to me. He was one to go too. And he's sort of looked out of my boots. He had all the boys in the dressing room. He started giving this big speech about wrestling boots. You gotta have wrestling boots to wrestle for this company. And JYD looked down at my freaking logging boots and he started laughing. He nudged me and pointed to my boots. But, you know, my booking, I think I had like 3 months left in my contract, and gosh, I think I worked 3 times in that 3 months. So I knew that, saw the writing on the wall. And a couple months before my contract was up is when I went up and started working for the WWF. And then went down when I got a contract with WWF. I went down, I think I had 2 weeks left in my contract, and with WCW, and I went down and asked Bill Watts if he would release me from my contract. And he agreed. He even agreed to, you know, he signed over the Doink, I mean, not the Doink, the Big Josh character to me that I could use, you know. I didn't tell him where I was going. You know, I just said, hey, can I use this Big Josh thing if I want? And so he drew up the papers and released that to me.
Is that a character you'd ever want to revisit, or you think it's best left forgotten to the mists of time?
No, you know what? It was part of my life, you know? It's part of my life. So, yeah, I don't mind, you know? I can be anybody. As long as I can be me.
As long as they're going to pay you.
Yeah, I can be anybody as long as I can be me. Yeah.
Now, you're based out of New Jersey right now, correct?
Yes, I am.
So, how often are you? How many indies are you looking to work right now? Are you going to do wrestling full time again? Like, do you have a plan in mind, or is it just let's see where life takes me?
I'm taking a day at a time. I've got a bunch of bookings now. But yeah, I'm open. I'm open to bookings, and I'm just looking forward to, you know, getting back and, you know, getting this thing going, and you know, hopefully that. You know, things will fall into place and I can stay busy with it. And, I live life a day at a time.
Cool. Do want to ask you, of course, this coming month, WrestleMania 26 is coming up. You worked the card of the first WrestleMania against Ricky Steamboat. At the time, from your point of view as a wrestler, did you have any idea of what a huge deal it was going to be, or was it just another house show to you? And do you remember what it was like backstage that night? Was there any sort of, like WWE, their urban legend is, there was all this excitement and all this magic. For yourself as a worker, going to the ring and wrestling that night, was it just another night for you? Was it just another night for the boys? What do you remember about that first WrestleMania?
You know what? It was kind of just like another show. It was a big show, though. It was MSG, but it was just kind of like another show. It was a pay-per-view. It was the first ever pay-per-view, so that aspect of it was huge. But, you know, and the crowd was huge, but it was just like, you know, we were working every day, and we were working in big houses and coliseums, and we were working in sometimes in high school gyms. And, you know, you work a big show, you work a smaller show. But they were packing the houses back then, and it was just kind of like another show, but it was huge. I knew it was big for Vince. I remember Vince coming back, and looking back, I could see, you know, how he was, you know, he was a bit on top of things a little bit more than he normally was. And I remember him pulling me into the shower, and he says, "You okay? You gonna go out there? Yeah, you know, perform, you know." And I just looked at him. I said, "Yeah, yeah." And you know, he knew that I was a little wild at the time, and I think he wanted to look in my eyes and see that I was clear. And I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm ready." You know, and he said, "Okay, okay." You know, but the atmosphere in the dressing room was just like another night. You know, I remember looking over at John Studd and Piper was in there and Morocco and it was just sitting around. Everybody was pretty much relaxed and, you know, another day in the office, you know?
Compare what it was like backstage there to, WrestleMania 9, where, you know, at that point it's already established as the big show of the year. Not one of the WWE's more stellar time periods. They were kind of on a downturn at that point. But here you are, 8 years later, it's now WrestleMania 9. What are the differences between being backstage at that first show and being backstage at what is now their biggest pay-per-view event of the calendar?
Well, there was a lot more going on backstage at WrestleMania 9. There was a lot more involved with it, you know. Guys were going over and doing these radio things. Guys were going over there and doing these, and you're constantly getting pulled off to the side to go do something. WrestleMania 1, it wasn't like that. It was just like another show. You get dressed, do a little interview before you go to the ring, and you go out there and do your thing. WrestleMania 9, after 8 of them, you know this is the big thing, the biggie, and so you know there's a lot more going on. I remember there's a lot more people in the back, a lot more family with the boys. In fact, my dad came down from Portland, and I flew him down there for, you know, to be with me on that. And it was, you just know from past experience that this is it, you know, this is the one. And, it was, you're more aware, at least that was the way it was for me. I'm more aware this is the one of the year, you know, so. Even though we do all the other pay-per-views, this is the biggie. Yeah, so you want to, for me, I was just, you know, more focused and, more focused.
Just like, was there more pressure on at the ninth WrestleMania or on the first?
More pressure on the ninth.
We didn't get a chance really to talk about Pacific Northwest, where obviously you worked. You held championships. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, that territory, even though it was very important to the creation of so many guys, whether it was yourself, Roddy Piper, Jesse Ventura, on and on and on, and there were great names that worked there, like Rip Oliver and Buddy Rose, whether it's just that the video library has been lost and it's not accessible, or it hasn't been purchased by WWE, or there hasn't been a DVD about it yet, that territory, for a lot of the fans today, is pretty much an afterthought, which is a shame, because it ran every week from years upon years. Don Owen ran for ever and a day. What are your memories of that territory? What do you think its legacy was? And what do you think are the biggest misconceptions or the forgotten things about that territory today?
Well, you know, first of all, Don Owens used to tape over. He never kept a library, and he would tape over the tapes from the week prior. So there was nothing ever kept on his territory, and that's really sad. But who would have known, you know, in the '60s that the world would be like it is today, you know? So, you know, if Don would have known that, I'm sure he would have, you know, being the businessman that he was, he would have, you know, taking them the steps to preserve all that. But that wasn't it. But that territory was a great territory. Don Owens was very open-minded, and he saw good minds come into that territory that could help him run things. And Roddy Piper was huge, you know, in his younger day. He just was like really quick and really a genius in putting butts in seats. And geez, it was on fire. It was on fire. Don Owens had went through the longest period of time where he sold out consecutively for like 3 months, 4 months straight. He turned people away at the door. And he had never done that before. And it was just a lot of short trips, you know, and it was just everybody wanted to go to that territory and work because you didn't have 500-mile trips to make every week, you know. It was just a real pleasure. And Jesse Ventura, Jesse was, when I was going to Portland State University, and Jesse rented an apartment from my father, and he was my neighbor. And so I became friends with Jesse before I broke into business. And, you know, he'd come home at night, and he'd say, "Matt, I'm home." I'd go over there, and we'd sit around and, you know, party a little bit and watch Saturday Night Live. I remember we used to, him and his wife, Terry, and I, and we'd sit around and laugh. And actually, that is what influenced me and gave me the desire to get into the business was that time spent with Jesse. And it was just great. You know, he was a great guy, and we laughed a lot. And, you know, I saw he was, you know, territory was doing good. He was making good money. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was just going to school, you know, because, you know, that's what I was doing. And so I had went to my father and told him that I wanted to break in the business, and he tried to discourage me a little bit at first. I think he just wanted to see if I was real serious, it was in my heart or not. But I kept on him, and then, you know, he said, "Okay," he says, but he, I remember him telling me, he said, "Okay, man," he says, "give yourself 2 years, 2-3 years. If you don't, if you'll know it if you got it, and if you don't, get out of it," you know. And I said, okay, you know. So I got the opportunity, and he went to Don Owens, and I think I got in the ring. But earlier than that, my dad used to run spot shows, and I used to drive the ring truck and set the ring up and be a timekeeper. And I knew the business, you know, but I'd never actually went in and worked, you know, in the ring. But I think I got in 2 or 3 times in the ring, and I was kind of a natural, you know. I could drop kick. First time I could drop kick somebody right in the face, and I could do all the moves. But, you know, I think I got in the ring 2 or 3 times. I never, you know, went in and trained hard. I always had respect for the business, but I just kind of like was thrown in there, you know, and learned that way. I started working, and Don Owens booked me. He started off booking me a couple times a week for 4 or 5 months, and then it went up to 3-5 times a week. And, you know, for the first year, it was kind of part-time. And then I went to Carolinas, and then I came back, you know. But, it was just, after being out and working some other territories and looking back, it was such an easy territory to work, you know, is what it was. Everybody loved it. It was like a vacation, you know. Somebody could, one of the boys could come out, go out to Oregon for a year. It would be like, geez, you know, because the work back then was the road. The road was the work, you know. Some of the Carolinas and Calgary. I mean, so those trips were, you know, horrendous. You live in your car, live in a van, you know.
Right. The Portland Sports Arena that Don Owen owned and ran. It was actually a converted, I think, a bowling alley, right? A bowling alley or a bingo, not a bingo hall, bowling alley or a flea market. What was the atmosphere like in that building versus some of the more intimate places that you've wrestled in, whether it was the Manhattan Center where Raw began, that little ballroom, or the ECW Arena, or other small places like the Sportatorium? Like, what was the atmosphere in that building like?
Well, you know what? It was a bowling alley, and actually, my father was real estate. In real estate, my father sold that building to Don Owens, and I remember when they were converting it. I would go down there with my dad and had meetings with Don and stuff, and it was had kind of a low ceiling, and the atmosphere was great because right off center was the crow's nest, and it sat up a little bit, and it was just perfect, you know, and the atmosphere was great, you know. I mean, back then you could smoke in buildings, and it was always kind of like a smoke-filled room, and it fit, like, I would say it fit. You could get 3,000 people in there. It, you know, the fire marshal probably said 2,500, but Don always snuck an extra 500 in there. And then when the fire marshal would show up, he was always nervous. I remember that. But it was a great atmosphere for the time, and especially when that place was filled up, it was just, you know, it was something else. It was something else. And as far as the Manhattan Center was, you know, was different, but, you know, I mean, it was limited in its capacity. I don't know how many fit in there, but
I think it's either 12 or 1,500.
Yeah,
I want to say 12, but it may be
that.
More.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was the atmosphere in the sports arena was something else.
Right. What do you think the legacy of that territory is?
Oh, man.
Was it just a breeding ground, or do you think it's just a forgotten piece of Americana? Like, what do you think that, like looking back, what do you think the importance of that territory was to the business?
I think it was a spot where guys could go before they went to, like, to New York or the Carolinas, because those two territories are the big ones then. Those were the big territories. Portland was a place where you could go, and if you were ready for that break, it was an opportunity for you to establish your creativity, because Don Owens had an open ear to guys, and he would more or less give everybody a chance to work on top, and if you freaking had it, you could roll with it, and he would roll with that. Don Owens had an open ear, and if you had that creativity, like the Roddy Pipers did, like the Buddy Roses did, like my father did, the Moondog Mains, you know, then you could establish yourself and then make that jump, because New York and the Carolinas, they knew what was going on in the smaller territories. And if they saw when these smaller territories were on fire, well, who's on top? Okay, then they keep an eye on that, and then, boom, they know who they want to bring in to that territory from the smaller ones because of their track record. And Portland was a great, the Northwest was a great breeding ground for that, because they were able to get that opportunity. Don Owens gave everybody on the card an opportunity to work on top. And that's something that other territories didn't. When you came in a top position, or you came in underneath, and, you know, if the politics worked right for you, you could, you know, work yourself up. But for the most part, you know, when you went into a territory, you went in under a certain position.
Right. For yourself as a performer, what do you think the biggest misconception of Matt Osborne or Matt Bourne, the performer, is today? And what do you think your personal legacy will be in the business?
Well, I don't know what people really think about me. I think people like to remember, you know, when somebody falls, and, you know, when somebody screws up, and, you know, nobody knows more than me how much I've screwed up. I want my legacy to be remembered as, you know, somebody that was as creative as I know I am, and is the worker that I know that I am, and not remember me for how many times I fell, but how many times that I picked myself back up. And that's what it is for me. It's harder to do now. To pick myself back up, because, you know, history, you know, the bigger your history is, you know, the more there is to come back on you. But You know what? I'm not the man I was years ago. I make better decisions. I'm clear-headed, and I love the business, and I want to I would really like a lot as many guys as possible down the road years from now to talk about how Matt Bourne influenced them, and Matt Bourne influenced them in a positive way, and I just want to give back. I want to give back to the business and make a living doing it is what I would really like to do. And if I can do that, you know, I'm not looking to be a star. I just want to perform to the best of my ability and be as creative as I can, and help the youth of the business today in reaching their potential.
All right. Two more questions, and then we'll let you go. You had the chance to return to WWE and Raw on the 15th anniversary show. What was your response and your reaction when you were invited to come back as Doink, when they could have brought Rey Apollo back? And what were your feelings that night, being part of the show again, and just your memories of that evening?
Actually, when I got the call, it was I got the call from Howard Finkel, and I got to thank Ricky Steamboat, because I was told Ricky Steamboat said that you gotta have Matt. You gotta have Matt. You know, he was the one that made this character, and so he pushed that, and my heart's with him, and I gotta thank him for that. And when I was there, it was an honor. I was honored. And when I got there, I was, you know, it was like, wow, you know, I walked in it, and the way it was catered and everything, when I walked in, it was, wow, it brought back memories. And it had been a while, and you know, I went in, and I was a bit nervous, actually, and I was there early, and I got to go around and see a bunch of guys I hadn't seen. I stood and talked to Steve Austin for probably an hour and a half out by the ring, and we reminisced over years past, and you know, I got to visit with Ricky Steamboat and Shawn Michaels, and you know, a bunch of guys that I hadn't seen in a long time, and it was a pleasure. It was an honor, and you know, I'm totally grateful for it. It was phenomenal, man. I really appreciate them asking me.
Finally, any final thoughts or comments, everybody listening to this? And are you looking forward to getting in the ring with Dutch Mantel March 27th in ISPW in Freehold, New Jersey?
You know what? All the years that I've been in the business, I've never worked with Dutch Mantel. And, how old is he now? You know, I don't know. You know, am I working with a geriatric? No, don't let him know that I said that. But no, you know what? It's a pleasure to get back into the ring and to be a part of the show. And I'm not really looking at it as a match with Dutch Mantel. I'm looking at it as being a part of the show, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to perform like Matt Bourne really can. So. I'm going to rise to the occasion, let's put it that way, and it's all good.
Well, Matt Bourne, you're going to get the chance to be born again on March 27th.
I'm already born again.
Well, there you go, already born again. You're going to be reborn again on March 27th. For more information on that, ispwwrestling.com. And again, thank you for joining us, and any final words?
No, I just, if you're in the area, come see me, and yeah, it's a, you know, all the fans out there. I hope I see you, and I hope you listen to me, and everything I said was straight from the heart and truthful. And, that's me, you know, that's all I can do.
Well, Matt, again, I want to thank you for joining us. For everybody listening to this, I want to thank you for your support at PWInsiderElite.com. And, Matt, hope you have a good day. And I know you're looking forward to March 27th, so hope it is everything you're looking for.
Sweet. Thank you very much.